Warping. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pacharane Nivasesa Sinivadi Paskatyagur Satana Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavam Shri Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Sarasajivam Sadvaitam Sadvaritam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitam Shri Bunch of cup, two pishaki, pisnidhi, pachapti, jam, pavane, the old Vaishnu, the old Vaishnu.
Hare Krishna.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
June 23rd, 2016, in Soho Street Temple in London. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th Canto, Chapter 3, Liberation from Illusory Energy, Text 40. Yar-yab-janab-ja-charanay-sharanyo-rubhaktya Jeto-malani-vidhame-guna-karma-jani Tasmin Vishuddha Upalabhyata Atma Tattvam
Tasmin Vishuddha Upalabhyata Atma Tattvam
Sakshad Yatama Lajusho Savitir Prakasha
Sakshad Yatama Lajusho Savitir
Prakasha. This chant?
Krishnaya.
Desiring only.
Desiring only.
Uru Bhaktya, by powerful devotional service, Jetaha, of the heart, Malani, the dirt, Vidhamet, cleanses away, Guna Karma Jani, generated from the modes of nature, and material activities in those modes. I forget that you can see it all. Tasmin,
in that
Vishuddhe,
completely purified heart,
Upalabhyate,
is perceived,
Atmatattvam,
the true nature of the self,
Sakshat, directly,
Yata,
just as,
Amalajusho,
of pure eyes,
Savitr,
of the sun.
It's
not Savitri. It's Savitri. It's a R. It's not a R. If it was a R, it would have a line on top of the R. If you think of Savitri, you're thinking of a different letter completely. You're thinking of the consonant Ra with the vowel E. This is the vowel R. Prakasha, the manifestation. Translation and purport. By the way, I want to ask you what's missing from this translation. There's something in the word for word that's missing. When one seriously engages in the devotional service of the personality of Godhead, fixing the Lord's lotus feet within one's heart as the only goal of life, one can destroy the innumerable impure desires lodged within the heart as a result of one's previous fruitive work within the three modes of material nature. When the heart is thus purified, one can directly perceive both the Supreme Lord and oneself as transcendental entities. Thus one becomes perfect in spiritual understanding through direct experience, just as one can directly perceive, experience the sunshine through normal, healthy vision. So what was in the verse that's not in the translation? Very beginning of the verse.
Directly perceiving the self.
question is, what is there that's in the Sanskrit that's not in the English?
The sun.
Well, sun is savitri. Yes. Very good. So that was just translated here as personality of Godhead. Actually, in the Sanskrit, it doesn't say personality of Godhead. It just says abjanava, which indicates the personality of Godhead. So in the translation, the translators were Dhyananda Maharshi Gopi. They elected just to simply say personality of Godhead instead of one who has a lotus name. Purport. In the previous, this is another one of these long, long philosophical purports. In the previous verse, it was explained that one can have a preliminary glimpse of the eternal, unchanging soul by remembering one's experience of peacefully sleeping, even while the mind and senses were totally inactive. One may ask, if in deep sleep there is a preliminary experience of the soul, why upon waking does one return to illusory material existence? By the way, that's a very extraordinary concept, which is opposite to the way most people, I think, even most devotees think. It may be answered that because of material desires lodged within the heart, the conditioned soul is addicted to the nescience of material sense gratification. A prisoner may glimpse through the bars the free light outside the prison window, but still remain captive behind the bars. Similarly, although a conditioned soul may have a glimpse of the spirit soul, he remains captured within the bondage of material desires. Therefore, although one may have a preliminary understanding of the eternal soul that exists within the temporary body, or even of the supersoul that accompanies the individual soul within the heart, a specific process is still required to eliminate the cause of material existence, namely material desire. As explained in Bhagavad Gita 8.6, yam yam bhapi svam bhavam tvajachan chekalevaram tam tam evaitikanteya sattat bhava bhavita. Whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, that state he will attain without fail. According to one's desire at the time of death, a suitable material body is awarded by material nature. Kamana divine trena jantra deha papadhyate. According to one's prudent desires and actions and under the jurisdiction of the representatives of the Lord called demigods, the living entity is awarded a particular material body which is inevitably subject to harassment by birth, death, old age, and disease. If one can eliminate the cause of a particular phenomenon, logically he also eliminates the effect. Therefore, this verse states that one should desire only to achieve shelter at the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead. One should give up illusory desires for material society, friendship, and love, since such desires cause further material bondage. One should fix his mind on the supreme personality of Godhead, Krishna, so that without fail one can remember Krishna at the time of death. As the Lord states, Ante kala chamam eva smana mukta kalevaram ya prayati samadvavam nasya yatra samshaya. Whoever at the time of death quits his body remembering me alone at once attains my nature, of this there is no doubt. Bhagavad Gita 8.5. The Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna is the actual shelter for every living being. And the Lord can be directly perceived as soon as one's heart has become transparently clean through bhakti yoga. Bhagavad Gita describes the state of achieving the Supreme Personality of Godhead by the words Tatomam Tatvatoganatvavishate Taranantaram. And sometimes impersonalists falsely interpret these words to be a description of Brahma Sayujya, or impersonal merging into the existence of the Lord. It is clearly mentioned in this verse that one must fix his mind and devotion on the lotus feet of Abjanava. What does that mean? Abjanava. Or the Supreme Personality of Godhead. If the individual living entity were equal to the personality of Godhead, the living entity would simply think of himself in order to be purified. Of course, Krishna did think of himself every morning in Dwarka. But even then, a contradiction would arise. The personality of Godhead has no need to be purified, since he is described in the Bhagavad Gita as Pavitram Padamam, or the Supreme Pure. Actually, Krishna does talk about purifying himself. How does Krishna say that he purifies himself?
Taking the dust of his devotees.
Krishna says he purifies himself by taking the dust of his devotees. Of course, that's rasa. That's tattva. That's not objective truth. Krishna can't purify himself. He purifies everybody. But he's in that mood. Such a nice understanding of God. God isn't just saying, come to me and be purified. He's saying, I have to come to you to be purified. Therefore, one should not artificially try to twist an impersonal meaning out of the statements of the Vedic literature. Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur has stated that the perfect stage of devotional service indicated in this verse can be observed in the activities of such great devotees as Dhruva Maharaj. Dhruva Maharaj approached the personality of Godhead, desiring a political adjustment on the material platform. But when purified by chanting the holy name of God, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, he felt no further need for material sense gratification. As stated in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Janayat Yasu Vairagyam, as soon as one advances in devotional service, one is freed from the embarrassment of superficial material desires. The words Upalabhyata Atmatattvam are significant in this verse. Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur says that Atmatattvam, or knowledge of the soul, indicates knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, along with his various expansions, such as the impersonal Brahmajyoti and the marginal living being himself, living entity himself. As indicated here by the word Shakshat, perceiving the personality of Godhead, meaning seeing the personal form of the Lord, his hands and legs, his various transcendental vehicles and servants, and so on. Just as by devotion to the sun god, one can gradually perceive the personal body of the sun god, along with his chariot and personal attendants. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur has pointed out that in verses 35 through 39, the various stages of standard logic are demonstrated. Verse 35 establishes the Vishaya, or general thesis. Verse 36 manifests Samshaya, or an expression of doubt. Verse 37 gives the Purva Paksha, or opposing argument. And verse 38 definitely establishes the Siddhanta, or conclusion. Verse 39 presents Sangati, the summary. The Sangati, or final word, is that one should become a pure devotee of the personality of Godhead and worship the Lord's lotus feet. Thus, by cleansing the mirror of the heart, one can see the Lord, just as a normal human being with healthy 20/20 vision can very easily see the brilliant rays of the sun, or as an advanced devotee of the sun god himself can see the personal body of the sun god. Yaryabdhanabja charanayashanayo rubakcha cheto malani dihamed gunakarmajani tasmin vishuda upalabhyata atmatatlam shakshad yatamaladrisho sabitripakashah. When one seriously engages in the devotional service of the personality of Godhead, fixing the Lord's lotus feet within one's heart as the only goal of life, one can destroy the innumerable impure desires lodged within the heart as a result of one's previous fruit of work within the three modes of material nature. When the heart is thus purified, one can directly perceive both the Supreme Lord and oneself as transcendental entities. Thus one becomes perfect in spiritual understanding through direct experience. Just as one can directly experience the sunshine through normal, healthy vision. Is anybody interested in us going through the system of logic before we get to the main thing of the verse? Anybody who's interested in that? It's a little technical. So let's look at this verse. So this is going back to text 35. So Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati says that text 35 establishes the Vishaya, or general thesis. So text 35 is about the Supreme Personality as the cause of creation, maintenance, and destruction. No prior cause. This is actually the last verse I talked about here. Pervading the various states of wakefulness, dreaming, and unconscious deep sleep, and also exists beyond them, entering the body of every living entity along with the senses, life, air, and mental activities, and all the subtle and gross organs of the body and their functions. Now this Lord is the Supreme. So that's the general thesis of the argument that's being made. You all know what a thesis is? What a thesis statement is? You all remember that? I'm going to school. The main topic? Right? Some of us went to school a long time ago. You know? And maybe we weren't paying attention that day. So even, you know, in a paragraph, you're supposed to have a topic sentence and then detailed sentences. Your thesis is, what is this paper about? You know, we also say you write a master's thesis or a doctorate thesis. It's on a particular subject. So the subject of this is the personality of Godhead who's everywhere. Okay, then we have 36 manifest samsaya, or the expression of doubt. So 36 says, neither the mind nor the faculties of speech, sight, intelligence, the life air, or any of the senses are capable of penetrating that supreme truth any more than small sparks can affect the original fire from which they are generated. Not even the authoritative language of the Vedas can perfectly describe the supreme truth, since the Vedas themselves disclaim the possibility that the truth can be expressed by words. But through indirect reference, the Vedic sound does serve as evidence of the Supreme Truth, since without the existence of Supreme Truth, the various restrictions found in the Vedas would have no ultimate purpose. So the first thesis was that you should know God, who's everywhere, and he's in the senses, and he's in the heart, and he's in all the states of consciousness. Then the doubt is, but we can't find him there. What good does that do for us to know that he's there? I can't find him. My mind can't find him. My senses can't find him. Even the sounds of the Vedas, right? Vedas should do the Bhagavad. Okay? Then text 37 gives the Purvapaksha or opposing argument. Okay? So text 37 is originally one. The absolute Brahman comes to be known as threefold. So whenever you have any kind of logic or debate, you always want to consider the opposing argument. Right? If you don't do that, then you're very foolish. That's something like mounting a battle without considering where the enemy is or who the enemy is. I'm just going to go out. And Krishna himself in the Bhagavad Gita talks about different opposing arguments. Here we find, again in the Shastra, we're looking at different opposing arguments, different opposing points of view to express doubt. Without doing these things, you're not going to have a solid argument. So here's an opposing argument, originally one. The absolute Brahman comes to be known as threefold, manifesting itself as the three modes of material nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance. Brahman further expands its potency, and thus the power to act and the power of consciousness becomes manifest, along with the false ego, which covers the identity of the conditioned living being. Thus, by the expansion of the multipotencies of the absolute, the demigods, as the embodiment of knowledge, become manifest, along with the material senses, their objects, and the results of material activity, namely happiness and distress. In this way, the manifestation of the material world takes place as a subtle cause and as a material effect visible in the appearance of gross material objects. Brahman, which is the source of all subtle and gross manifestations, is simultaneously transcendental to them, being absolute. So this is establishing, of course, a Jinta Beda Tattva, but it's also establishing a very different way of looking at the world than was established in the thesis. Does that make sense to everybody? It's a different perspective than the thesis. Okay, 8:38 establishes the Siddhanta or conclusion. In other words, thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. So in 38, Brahman, the eternal soul, was never born and will never die, or does it grow or decay? That spiritual soul is actually the knower of the youth, middle age, and death of the material body. Thus, the soul can be understood to be pure consciousness existing everywhere, at all times, and never being destroyed, just as the life air within the body, although one, becomes manifest as many in contact with the various material senses. The one soul appears to assume various material designations in contact with the material body. So this synthesizes the doubt, how can we approach the Lord, although he's everywhere. It also synthesizes, he's everywhere, he's the creator, but also he's transcendental. And then we have the summary in text 29. Which is the spirit soul is born in many different species of life within the material world. Some species are born from eggs, others from embryos, others from the seeds of plants and trees, and others from perspiration. But in all species of life, the prana or vital air remains unchanging and follows the spirit soul from one body to another. Similarly, the spirit soul is eternally the same despite its material condition of life. We have practical experience of this. When we are absorbed in deep sleep without dreaming, the material senses become inactive. And even the mind and false ego are merged into a dormant condition. But all the senses, mind, and false ego are inactive, one remembers upon waking that he, the soul, was peacefully sleeping. So that's the summary. And this is a nice model. This is a very nice model for how to develop an argument. So recently, I heard one devotee who's a scholar, and frankly, who should know better. And they wrote, as far as such and such argument is concerned, I already understand the conclusion. I don't need to look at the Shastra. I don't need to look at any evidence. It's just obvious to me. And the other position is absurd and abnormal and weird and shouldn't even be considered. So that's not the process of knowledge. That's not the process of argument and logic. The process of argument and logic is you state your thesis, and then you say, well, but there could be a doubt about this thesis. And from this doubt, we can have the antithesis, we can have the other perspective. How do I synthesize the thesis and the antithesis, keeping in mind the doubt, to get a synthesis? And then how do I summarize my final conclusion? If we don't take into account doubts and antithesis, then we cannot come up with a proper synthesis. Okay, so let's look at today's verse. Today's verse starts out with the conception, very odd, I would say, very surprising, that it is in deep sleep that we are most in touch with the soul. You know, I've heard from many devotees the opposite concept. I remember someone even submitting an article to Back to Godhead like this. Well, you know, I'm one of the editors. So we go through all these interesting submissions. And, you know, he was presenting what I think is a reasonable conclusion of a conditioned soul, that deep sleep is in ignorance, dreaming is in passion, wakefulness is in goodness. That we're the closest to truth and the closest to the soul when we're waking, less so when we're dreaming, and even less so when we're in deep sleep. But the Shastra is saying exactly the opposite. That we are the furthest from spiritual consciousness when we're in wakefulness. We're closer when we're dreaming, and we're the closest in deep sleep. I'm sure you all know that Krishna comes to many devotees in their dreams. That your consciousness is closer. It's more open. And deep sleep is very much like in the Astanga Yoga system, Pratyahara. Pratyahara is the state before samadhi, where you withdraw all your senses from the sense objects. So especially in deep sleep, our senses are withdrawn from the sense objects, correct? We don't see anything, we don't feel anything, we don't taste anything. Isn't that correct? Okay? We're in deep sleep. And also in deep sleep, as mentioned, the mind and the intelligence and even the false ego are shut down. Now when a yogi goes into a trance, what they do is they shut down the mind and try to function on the platform of intelligence. The accepting, rejecting of the mind. And if they're a more advanced yogi, they also shut down the intelligence and try to work on the platform of the ego. Waking the kundalini, which is going the shakti, going to Shiva, the false ego. And if they're really, really advanced, then they shut down the false ego and they're just on the platform of the self. So because most of us are not that advanced, when we go into deep sleep, we just become unaware. Because really only the soul is active at that time, and our soul is not very active. So we don't have much experience of being active at all. Of course, it's explained that transcendental consciousness is beyond even deep sleep. It is Turiya, or the fourth state of consciousness. We all have examples in the Shastra of yogis and devotees going into such a deep state of samadhi that they became unaware. Yes? Of their surroundings? Can you give me some examples?
Hiranyakashipu.
Yes, of course, it was a devotee. That is a yogi.
Haridas Thakur.
Yes, Haridas Thakur, he went into this state. He went into this state of complete withdrawal from the external world, and the guards thought he was dead. They threw him into the Ganga.
Sanatana Goswami? One of the Goswamis
absorbed,
and somebody
killed Rupa Goswami, yes.
Madan Maharaj, when he was attacked by all the demons.
And he went into a state of samadhi. Okay. Some other examples?
Shamakarishi.
Shamakarishi? Yes. Any other examples?
Srini's father, the beginning of Bhagavatam, I can't remember the sage.
That was what you meant. Lord Shiva at the Daksha Yajna? Also, right? He wasn't even aware that Daksha had entered into the yajna. So there's many examples like that, that a person in deep meditation, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself, whenever he would go into internal consciousness, that he had external consciousness, internal consciousness, and mixed consciousness, and whenever he was in internal consciousness, he had no awareness of what was going on around him, right? Yes? Okay. So this verse is primarily about how bhakti works. This chapter is entitled Liberation from Illusion of Energy. And how is it that bhakti liberates us from the illusory energy? So to understand that, that would be nice to know how bhakti works, right? Because Prabhupada talks about the science of bhakti, that it's a science. If it's a science, one should be able to explain how it works. Now, explaining how something works, we may think, we could say, well, you would explain the mechanism of it. If you're going to explain how something works, you know, how does this microphone work, or how this body works, you think of it as a machine. However, the difficulty with explaining the mechanism of bhakti is that it's not mechanical. We're really explaining how something works that's personal and relational. So the other day I was speaking with a devotee who's trying to make resources available to help other devotees in their marriage relationships. So this devotee had compiled all these articles from devotees and non-devotees about male-female psychology and the marriage relationship and all these things, relationship with the children. So in one sense, they're explaining how it works. How does the relationship between the husband and wife and between the parents and the children work? At the same time, those are not mechanical relationships. Does that make sense to everybody? If the wife just says, okay, dear, you know, I cooked your favorite meal of lasagna, and I cleaned the house, and I finally sewed your kurta that's been broken for the last 3 months that you've been complaining about, so now you have to love me. It's not going to work. Right? If the man says, okay, you know, I brought you a diamond bracelet, and I brought you a dozen roses, and now you have to love me. Does that work? No. So, when we're talking about a relationship between two persons, it's not a mechanical thing. At the same time, you can describe how it works. Does that make sense to you? You can describe how it works. You can say, well, when a person says this, this is what they want, and this is the way. I mean, the Shastra describes husband should treat his wife like this, the wife should treat her husband like this, or the disciple should treat the guru like this, the guru should treat the disciple like this. Am I correct? Yes? So it's describing, in one sense, how do the relationships work, but yet they're not mechanical. You can't do that with the guru either. You can't go to the guru and say, no, chanting my 16 rounds, follow the four good principles, came to Mangalarti every day, went out and distributed 10,000 million books, you know, waved 10,000 million sticks of incense. Okay, Krishna Prema, come on. It's not going to work. Right? You can't. Do you follow what I'm saying? It's not like that. Because it's not. In fact, if we take it like that, then the person will become offended. We think that they're a machine. So please keep in mind, as we're describing how bhakti works, that doesn't mean it's something mechanical. That doesn't mean that you can just say, you know, if I just punch all the buttons, that then Krishna's going to say, hi! Like it's an app on your phone. Alright, so here is talking about the system of entanglement and the system of liberation. So let's look at entanglement first. In the purport, it's mentioned that the cause of our entanglement, our prison, is our material desires. Now, when we say material desires, we don't mean a desire to get a certain car, or a desire to get a certain pair of shoes, or that's not exactly what we mean. Or a desire to get married, a desire to have a house, a desire to have money. When people think of material desires, that's what they think. But there are many great devotees who said, you know, I want to buy that car. Or even the young Brahmana who traveled to Vrindavan with the older Brahmana came to him and said, I want to marry your daughter. So these things are not necessarily indicative of material desires. What makes something a material desire is when, well, what? What makes something a material desire?
It's not done in the name of Krishna.
If it's not done to satisfy Krishna, anything that's not connected with Krishna, or as Krishna says in the chapter Sloka, anything without relation to me has no reality. Know it to be my illusory energy, that reflection which appears to be in darkness. So anything that's not aimed as satisfying, not just in relation to Krishna, but as aimed to satisfy, he's translated. It's fine. He's translating. Yeah, it's fine. You don't have to give him a look. It's fine. Satchinanda Maharaj talked about how one time he was teaching a seminar and some guys were talking, or some, I don't know, ladies, men were talking in the back of the seminar, and he was agitated the whole time. You know, it's like the whole time, he's like, why can't they stop talking? Why can't they stop talking? You know, and then at the end, one of the things my mochman then said, oh, it was a very nice class. And then he said, how did you even hear it. Well, I was really hearing because I was translating for my friends. This is a small temple. What can you do? We don't have, like, in Ljubljana, they have UN-type facilities, if you've ever been there. So they have headphones. You know, somebody's translating quietly to a microphone and everybody hears on the headphones. Okay, so material desires is when I'm putting myself at the center. When I'm saying, instead of wanting to satisfy the senses of the Lord, I want to satisfy my senses independently of the Lord. So it's not exactly the thing. It's not, do you want a car? But it's, why do you want a car? It's not, do you want a house? It's, why do you want a house? It's not even, do you want to get married? It's, why do you want to get married? It's not, do you want to get money? But why do you want to get money? That makes something a spiritual desire or a material desire. Is that clear to everyone? And material desires, of course, manifest themselves in terms of our identification with this body, but that's because as soon as you have a desire to enjoy separately from Krishna, immediately one has to be put under illusion, because there is no such thing as anything separate from Krishna. It doesn't exist. You can't do that. Everything is connected with Krishna. So therefore, as soon as you want to see things separately from Krishna, you have to be put under a kind of illusion, where you no longer see the connection. You follow? Because Krishna is fulfilling everyone's desire. Eko bhavanam yobhidadati. Come on. So I want to try to see things as separate from you and enjoy separately from you. Okay, here's an illusion where all the connections are become invisible. We start seeing everything as separate. I'm separate from you, you're separate from me. We're all separate from Krishna. The material world is separate from Krishna. Or there just isn't even any Krishna. There's no God. You know, we're just here. So this illusion becomes very specific. It comes in three modes of material nature. It's not just one illusion for everybody. It comes in different colors and flavors. You know, I want to enjoy ice cream. Okay, but there's 33 flavors of ice cream. 100, I don't know how many flavors are of ice cream. So many flavors of ice cream. So this is a combination of the three modes of nature, and they combine. And I'm going to forget Krishna in this way. Well, I'm going to forget Krishna in this way. And these modes produce our material body, as explained very nicely in this purport. That as we have a particular desire to see the world, to perceive the world as being separate from Krishna, that particular desire manifests as a particular body and mind and a particular false ego and the whole story of our life. And then our material desires manifest as a desire to satisfy that body and mind, which are the external symbol, you could say, of material desire, of the desire to enjoy separately from Krishna. The desire to enjoy separately from Krishna takes a form. It manifests as a form. And then we try to satisfy that illusory form. Does this all make sense to you? Are you able to follow this? I can't satisfy me, the soul, separate from Krishna. It doesn't work. That's not reality. So if I want to try to satisfy myself as separate from Krishna, I have to have a false self, which also, by the way, happens to be to be connected with Krishna. In my body and mind are also Bhumirapanova Bayukamano Buddha Cha. It's also connected with Krishna. But I have this false identity that I'm trying to satisfy separately from Krishna. While I watch. It's kind of weird, isn't it? Right? Bhagavad Gita chapter 5, chapter 13. Krishna said, you're not doing anything. You, the soul, are not doing anything. You're just watching. You just watch and you desire. So, Sadhguru gave the analogy of virtual reality. And I'm sure, you know, all of you have seen or heard of computer games where people create a character in the game. So if you desire to do something that you're not capable of doing, you know, like fighting with a million monsters at once and defeating them, you know, if you want to do that, which we can't do, and I don't, any of you can do it, maybe some of you can do that, as far as I know, oh, there you go. But I think most of us, you know, we can't fight a million monsters at once and defeat them all, jump off a cliff or something. So when we have these desires, which are illusory, we create this illusory character in the computer game, and then we observe our illusory character doing things that we cannot do in reality. Does that make sense to you? And when the illusory character does things that we can't do in reality, due to our identification with that illusory character, then we rejoice or we lament. So that's very, very much like what's happening in the material world. We are observing this body and this mind and this false ego interacting with the sense objects according to the modes of material nature, and we are trying to fulfill the desires of this body and this mind and the false ego. Mostly we're trying to fulfill the desires of the false ego. And when somebody praises us and when we're seen as very intelligent and very competent, we think, yes, I'm enjoying. And when we're embarrassed or when we're thwarted or when it shows that we've made some mistake, then we become ashamed and we lament. So that's our basic entanglement. So how do we get unentangled? So here in this verse, it's talking about going right to the source. Go right to the desires and shift them. Now, Bhakti Yoga also works from the effect. So because Bhakti Yoga engages the body and the mind, and frankly, Bhakti Yoga also engages the false ego. Very, very frankly. You know, okay, you think that you're a this, be a this for Krishna. You understand? Yeah? Alright, you're a fighter, fight for Krishna. You're a scholar, scholarly for Krishna. Scholar for Krishna. Okay. You like money, make money for Krishna. You're this person's son, okay. Take care of your mother and father for Krishna. So it takes that false identification, that upadhi, and engages it. That's pretty far out, isn't it? Unlike the other systems of yoga that just say, smash it! Right? Smash it. Well, not karma yoga. Vishnu yoga and Jnana yoga. Smash it, destroy it. Of course, we say sarvapadi vinirmuktam, but we do sarvapadi vinirmuktam by engaging the upadhi in Krishna service. Pretty interesting method. Interesting method. So we're doing that, you could say, kind of outside in. We're saying, take the body you have, use it for Krishna. Take the mind you have, use it for Krishna. Even take the false ego and use it for Krishna. You have donated 100 million pounds for Krishna. Here is your name on a plaque on the wall. That is complete false ego, folks. Completely. I mean, totally. You've distributed the most books of anybody. Come up and get your plate of Mahaprasada. Total ahankar. But we use that also in Krishna service because, you know, you can't, until you're purified, you can't really go on without that very well. You know? If nobody ever says to you, you are great, then you just get discouraged and you think, what am I doing here? Nobody appreciates me. You know? I need to go someplace else. I remember as a very new bhakti, we were riding in the Sankirtan van in this Brahmacharini. Hare Krishna. When my daughter was going to get initiated, before the initiation, her Guru Maharaj said to me, does she want to keep her birth name? Maybe a little adjustment. I said, no, it's a very common name. She's waiting for it to be changed. Of course, now she's also met, you know, dozens of people with her initiated name. So he showed me four names, and he said, are any of these names, do you have some negative association with any of these names? And one of them was the name of that Brahmacharini who was in the van that day. And I said, not that one. So we were in the van that day going to the airport, and this devotee looked at me and she said, you know, Armila, you don't have any love for Krishna. I was a devotee like a week or two, right? You know, and I thought, you're just here for your ego and your sense gratification. You don't have any real love for Krishna. And I just went, I sat in the van just crying. And I was thinking, you know, my ego was so bruised and offended, and I was sitting there thinking, oh, I should just leave that and go home to my mother. So, you know, you can't deal with people that way. It doesn't work very well. So you just say to somebody, you only did 600 Maha Big Books today? You think Krishna's impressed with that? You know? You puny little 1/10,000th, the tip of a hair of this puny little earth planet and this puny little universe. Go to the back of the room. You know. So we can't deal with people that way. Of course, there was one devotee who once stood up and asked a question to Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada, I am the most fallen of Prabhupada. You're not the most anything. Just sit down. But generally, you can't deal with people like that. So Bhakti Yoga is very nice that we even use the false ego in Krishna's service. Right? It's, that's for that. You can say this from the outside in, but the bhakti yogis also work. Bhakti yogis also working from the inside out. So this verse is about inside out. Change the desires. Go right to the soul and change the desires. Yes, engage the body, engage the mind, even engage the philosophy, the Hare Krishna. But work on the desires within the heart. Change the desires. Change the emotion. Now, if we're only working outside in, my friends, it will take a very, 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 very long time. If you really like the verse, Bhavanam Janmanam Mante, if that's your favorite verse in the Bhagavad Gita, or Manushyanam Sahasrasu, if you really like those verses about the rarity of bhakti, about the, how long it takes to attain Krishna, if those, yes, I want to take a long time and have it be very rare, you know, I'm looking forward to millions of births before I can see Krishna, then all right, just work from outside, and eventually, it will percolate down to the desires. Eventually, what we're doing, and Krishna explains this in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, in text 9 and 10, Krishna Karmani, he said, if you can't engage in sadhana bhakti, then just work from it. So that's external. And we have, just to be frank, we have a lot of members of our Krishna consciousness movement who are really only comfortable working on that platform. They really don't want to change their desires. They don't want to look within the heart. They really don't. I mean, I recently encountered a lady like this, and she and her husband were talking to me. And her husband was talking to me about rather deep transformative stuff. And she looked at me and she said, I have no interest in these things. And I said, well, can I talk to you frankly? And she said, yes. And I see. I said, it's very obvious in your dealings with your husband, with me, with everybody, that there's something bothering you in your heart. There's something not right. And she immediately got frustrated. She said, I don't want to talk about that. My guru said, chant 16 rounds, follow the regular principles. That's what I'm doing. I'm just going to go chant my rounds. Goodbye. Don't talk about the heart. So, okay. Don't bring it up again. So there's many, many people who are like this. They're saying, well, can't I just follow the externally? Can't I just follow the process externally? Will that work? Yes, it will work. Krishna says, Krishna Karmani, if you just work for Krishna, eventually you come to the perfect stage. But bhakti yoga, if you're really going to do bhakti yoga, that has to work both outside in and inside out simultaneously. Because bhakti yoga starts, Nectar Devotion chapter 2, bhakti yoga starts with always thinking about Krishna. Bhakti yoga starts with trying to change one's desires. That's the beginning of Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti. Oh, that's a very high stage. No, no, no. That is the beginning of Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti. That's when it starts. So if one is not working on that, frankly, one has not even started Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti. One is just doing Krishna Karmani. One is working for Krishna. Which is okay. It would work after some time. Just like there's a... Prabhupada said in one lecture, if you're chanting Hare Krishna but thinking of materialistic things, he says, then it is useless. And then he has a long pause. He said, or it will take a long time. He said, what is the use of your reading Krishna book? He said, you're reading Krishna book so you can think about Krishna when you're chanting. He said, otherwise it is deviation. He said, when you're chanting, you should remember Krishna's instructions to Arjuna, or you can remember how Krishna's killing a demon and the cowherd boys are encouraging him with claps. So this verse is talking about inside out, starting with changing the desires, starting with really meditating on Krishna with emotion, not meditating on Krishna as a philosophical concept, not meditating on Krishna just intellectually, but maya shakta mana partha, maya shakta, ashakta mana partha, with ashakti, with attachment. That means that there is some engagement of the emotions, that I really want to try to please Krishna. I really want to try to become attached to him. Now, as that changes from within, the modes start to withdraw. Because you're indicating to Krishna that you don't want them anymore. Once you're starting to indicate to Krishna from your inner desires and inner emotions that you want to put him in the center where he belongs, that you want to stop pretending that you're in the center, then illusion is no longer necessary. And proportionally, as we cultivate this emotion and attachment towards Krishna, to that extent the modes start to withdraw. As the modes withdraw, our fruitive actions and reactions cease, and our vision clears. This is Chaito Dharpana Margin. Our vision clears. Our vision does not clear until our desires change. Our desires, because that's the whole problem. If I want to put myself at the center, and if I want to be great and wonderful and never make a mistake and, you know, be perfect in so many ways, then I can't have clear vision because I'm wanting something that's not real. Do you follow the logic of this? I want something that's not real, therefore I must be put into illusion. And the illusion's not going to be withdrawn until I want something that's real. Does that all make sense? Is that like logical? So that's how bhakti works. Bhakti works, change your desire to be an illusion, and then illusion will withdraw. As illusion withdraws, one will perceive directly. Prajnaksha. One will just perceive directly. Both God and oneself. Now, in bhakti yoga, if we have glimmers of this change of desire, then we have a glimmer of truth. I'm sure we've all experienced that. We have some moment where our desire, our attachment, really flows to Krishna. And in that moment, it's like the, you know, here in the purports describing like the prisoner who sees through the bars of the jail without being outside. Or it can also be the curtains part for a moment. You know, or here in London, one of your rare days of sunshine, you know, rare moments. How do you like the British summer? You know, it's like the what? They don't have summer in Britain, you know, they have a long, long, early spring. But occasionally, you know, occasionally the clouds part and there's a little bit of sunshine, yes? Occasionally. Oh, there's actually sun on top of this island. And then again, you know, the rain and the cold. So as we have these little glimmers of desire and attachment, genuine desire and attachment for Krishna, however they're sparked, by devotees, by our chanting, by the deities, whatever, by our preaching, then, wow, look at that, that's truth. But unless we cultivate those, just like later on in the 11th canto, I think it's in chapter 17, where Krishna says to Uddhava that you're rubbing the sticks together. He's talking about chanting, like rubbing sticks together to make a fire, and then there's a little spark. And then you have to pour ghee on the spark for the fire to blaze. So these little moments where we have some genuine attachment to Krishna, genuine emotion to Krishna, those little sparks, it's not like we just want to watch them. Wow, I just got an incredible glimpse of truth. Woo! But you want to cultivate it. You want to pour ghee on it. You want to nourish it. You want to meditate on it. And then we will see everything directly. Then we will experience the truth of the Shastra for ourselves. And eventually, as Maya recedes completely, then we will be living in truth. You'll always be living in the truth, and then Krishna explains, for one who never departs from the truth, he relishes and rejoices in the self, and for such a person, they easily transcend the miseries of material existence. So this verse also gives us some hint as to how we can develop this attachment, this emotional attachment. Attachment is an emotion, yes? How we can develop this emotional attachment for Krishna. This is how we're going to think of Krishna all the time. We say, always remember Krishna, never forget him. That's not mechanically. It doesn't mean that you put some kind of, you know, device on your head like and have a little picture of Krishna that you kind of walk around. You know, if your mind's someplace else, you won't even see the picture after all, isn't it? Right? We have all these pictures on the walls. Forget them. So the main way that we always think of someone or something or whatever is through attachment. And it can even be negative attachment. If you're afraid of something or someone, you may think of them all the time. Also, yam krodha kamasaha paniyati vatsalya moha guru gaurava sevya bhava samchintatasam sabhi samtanyavaparita. So here's one clue, little hidden clue, about how to develop attachment in this abjanabha. So ja is short for birth, and ab is short for for water. It's a short, like abbreviated form of water. So abja means water birth. So of course there's many living entities, fish and plants and mammals even, that take birth in the water. So if you just say waterborne, they're B-O-R-N, not B-O-R-N-E. If you just say waterborne, that could indicate so many things. But in Sanskrit, this term waterborne or sometimes mudborne, pankaja, panka means mud, pankaja, mudborne, born in the mud, born in the water. So these are poetic ways of indicating the lotus flower. Just like in Sanskrit, they often will call the heart the cave. Instead of saying the heart, they say the cave. So every language has its idioms, yes? It's poetic expressions. Just like when I was growing up, my parents would say, okay, time to hit the road. So they don't mean you take out your sticks and go to the street and start banging it. They mean you get in your car and start driving, or you get in your, you go out and start walking. So we have all of these sort of idiomatic expressions. So waterborne refers not to whales, and it doesn't refer to crabs or crayfish or kelp or something like that. It refers just to the lotus. Then nubba means a navel. Now, of course, it's interesting that God even has a navel, because our navels are the sign that we were in the womb. Right? If anybody wants to say, well, I just appeared here, then we'll say, well, where'd your navel come from? That indicates that we spent time in our mother's womb, where we were nourished, where we were getting our food and oxygen and the removal of our waste through the umbilical cord leading to the mother. It's our lifetime symbol that we were born. So what is Krishna doing with the navel? You could say, well, he takes birth from Devaki and Rohini, you know, and Yasoda. But we're talking even about Narayana. Whereas he's not taking birth from anybody. Mahavishnu, he's not taking birth from anybody. Even in Leela, right? We don't have any Leela like that. We have Varaha, who takes birth from Brahma's nose. I don't think there's any umbilical cord. Or, you know, Nisingadevi, who takes birth from a pillar. Or Kurma, who just kind of appears there. Kurma and Matsya, there's no specific mention of manifestation. So what's he doing with the navel? So the Lord's navel is quite different. From the Lord's navel, he has the umbilical cord comes out of his navel and produces the world. It's happening in reverse. He's nourishing the world through his navel rather than the world nourishing him. He's the mother of the universe. He calls himself the father and the mother of the universe in the Bhagavad Gita. So from his navel sprouts the stem of a lotus flower. So his navel itself is considered to be lotus-like. I mean, here it says shaped like a lotus, but that doesn't mean literally. That would be rather strange. But in other words, it's very beautiful. So it's a lotus navel. I mean, I don't think any of our navels are particularly beautiful. And from it comes this lotus stem. And an actual lotus flower comes from his navel, on which Brahma is situated, and all the planets are within his stem. Little indication of the beauty of the Lord. There's many poetic descriptions of the navel of the Lord, especially in the works of the Goswamis and Krishnadas Kaviraj, but also in the Bhagavatam itself, how the Lord's navel is like a lake, right? With the little dark hairs from his navel are like little swans that are going to swim in the lake. So we can develop an attachment to the Lord. This lotus navel is indicative of the beauty of the Lord's form. So generally we become attached to beautiful forms. Isn't that a fact? We meditate on beautiful forms. Beautiful forms within this world, attractive men or women, or beautiful animals, right? Deer and tiger and horses and whales, some kind of beautiful, majestic animal, or some beautiful scenery, some mountains and flowers. And we become attached to beauty. Isn't that a fact? So by the beauty of the Lord's form, even his navel, which we think of as an insignificant part of a form. If I'm going to be attached to the beauty of someone's form, I'm going to think about their eyes or their eyebrows or their lips or something like that. Not their navel. You know, generally find, I really want to marry that girl. Why is that? Oh, look at her navel. You know, yeah, it would be a little odd. But the Lord's beauty is so incredibly attractive. You know, we have meditations on the soles of his feet. Meditation on his navels, meditation on the tips of his fingers, that every part of the form of the Lord is gorgeous. And just, you know, meditating on one toenail, the devotee can hardly even take their eyes away from the toenail of the Lord or the navel of the Lord. And Kunti Devi starts with the Lord's abdomen. She starts with the Lord's belly. And we have, in our Dhammadrastika, we pray like that, right? Namaste is to Dhamma Israel, Yukti Dhamma. Twadi udarai patam. Udara is your belly. Vishvas vadamne. your belly, which is the abode of the universe. So it's a prayer to the Lord's stomach, to the Lord's belly, to the Lord's navel. And then we can become attached to the Lord also philosophically, how from the Lord's navel the universe is coming, the amazing stories of the creation of the world from the navel, or perhaps to Rasa, how Mother Yasoda is tying up Krishna by his belly and trying to put this rope over his navel, or the servants there tying on Krishna's clothes and adjusting it over his navel. Gopis there hanging a garland that hangs down below the belly of the Lord. So in this way, by meditating on the Lord as Abhijanava, we can develop this internal change of desire and attachment, and it is this internal change of desire and attachment which is going to remove the clouds of illusion and enable us to practically see the Lord face to face, and to see ourselves face to face, to really see ourselves in the mirror of the consciousness, to know who we are, to know who the Lord is, and to achieve the supreme goal of life. So, questions, comments, additions, subtractions, chastisements. Yes,
Prabhu. You were discussing we even engage the false ego.
Mm-hmm.
I have an understanding which may not be correct. It's more of a counter application that when we engage our talents in Krishna's service, that which you're good at. The reason you're good at it is because you came here to enjoy it. You want to enjoy something, you've got to be good at it. So that which you're good at is going to be most intimately connected to the false ego. Therefore, engage what you're good at should be done with caution, because that's where you're approaching your false ego the most. And therefore, while not understanding it for Krishna, it's also inherently that which you came to enjoy the most. So in Krishna consciousness, we are going to find, as it was in Manasiksha, very subtly, this is what I'm trying to enjoy, and I've just now covered it with that thing for Krishna.
Absolutely. So, but what does Krishna tell Arjuna to engage specifically?
Right.
What he's good at.
My question is to take qualifications in that, or should we just...
That should start immediately. And in fact, devotees make a mistake if they think I should intentionally avoid what I'm using, what I'm good at in Krishna's service, because it's so wrapped up with my false ego and my pride. And therefore, I should intentionally only do the things that I'm bad at. So that would be a very strange practical management procedure. So if as, you know, the temple president or the temple commander, if you said, okay, everybody should do the things that they're most incompetent at. Because if you do the things that you're good at, you're going to be proud. Whereas if you do what you have the least competence in, then you're going to become very humble.
Is there not a little balance in between?
It would be a very... I don't know if I'd want to visit that temple where everybody was engaged at their level of greatest incompetency as a way of producing humility. Well, Krishna says... I'm not saying. Krishna says. And he says it twice. So good teachers repeat that which is important. And not only does he say it twice, he also says it in the 18th chapter. So good teachers repeat the important things in the summary. So I'm going to take this as pretty important. He says, you have your nature, Arjuna, your choice is to do it for me or do it for Maya. If you do it for me, you'll have everything. You want all victory. If you do it for Maya, you'll be lost. So I see that there's a very, very, very strong message in the Bhagavad Gita. Whatever you are good at. Now, you are absolutely, totally correct. The things that we are good at in this life represent the specific flavor of the way in which we want to exhibit our false ego at this particular time. That may be different in the next life and the next life. Sometimes people are good at something for many lives, like Prabhupada talked about the Beatles, that they had been practicing music for many, many lifetimes. And some things, you know, are going to change your mind. You get bored of it afterwards. Okay, I finished with music. Now let me try something else. I've done it for the last 150 lifetimes. You know, now let me try to enjoy the world in a different flavor. But it is absolutely a fact. What we are good at in this life, our nature, what comes to us easily. If you want to, how do you define nature? I recently read a wonderful definition. That which is as easy as breathing, you're hardly even aware that you do it. You do it without effort. You do it without being asked. You do it without being paid. It just comes naturally that you really do. Of course, if you're not trained, it may come out in a funny way. So where does that come from? That comes from previous life's desires of how I wanted to enjoy the world. And it may come from previous life's austerity. We may have undergone a lot of austerity and sacrifice to develop those particular talents, which in this life just appear as nature. They may still need to be trained and honed in this life. You follow? I gave the example the other day about nature when we were talking about man and women's nature. I said, you know, when I was 3 years old and I was in preschool, so it was a family joke from the time I was three upwards, when I was three, the teachers came to my parents and said, you know, your daughter is really a problem in the school. And they said, why? They said, because she refuses to be one of the students. She wants to be one of the teachers. So, had I been with more enlightened parents, and I mean, all respect and love to my parents, but had I been with all more enlightened parents, they would have said, oh, that must be her nature, and trained me accordingly. And they didn't. In fact, that complaint of the teacher was seen as something bad. You follow? And I spent a large chunk of my life trying to repress and ignore that part of my nature. And it really wasn't until I met Jyotirmayi when I was 24 that I had any inkling that I liked teaching and that I could be a good teacher. So something that's manifesting when you're 3 years old, that means and everyone's nature manifests when they're 3, 4 years old, by the way. That's something that we probably worked for in a previous life, maybe many previous lives. We put a lot of effort into it. We did a lot of austerity, maybe a lot of prayers, but that's the way we wanted to enjoy the world. Absolutely. So it is the manifestation of our false ego. It's our upadhi. I remember Bhaji Biharapuru of ISKCON Resolve. He was talking about a devotee who died in Vrindavan and after a long illness. She was an artist, and she got so sick that she couldn't do any art anymore. And she said one of the most difficult things was giving up this self-concept, I am an artist. And I think this is one of our greatest fears, that I will become incapacitated in some way, that I will no longer be able to serve Krishna in that way. I mean, I'm having trouble with this cough and this sore throat. My throat is really raspy. I was coughing a lot last night. And I was thinking this morning, am I going to be able to talk? And there was this fear. I was like, what am I going to do if I can't talk? That's what I do. People will say, where are you going? I'm going here and there. What are you going to do there? I said, well, what do you think I'm going to do? I'm going to talk and I'm going to write. That's what I do. You take the grain threshing machine to heaven or hell and threshes grain. But that's not ultimately who we are. We do have to give up this idea, I'm not a Brahmana, I'm not a Kshatriya, I'm not a Vaishya, I'm not a Shudra, I'm not a man, I'm not a woman. I'm not a Brahmachari, I'm not a Grahastha, I'm not a Vanaprastha, I'm not a Sannyasa, I'm not a Tel President, I'm not a Pujari, I'm not a cook, I'm not British, I'm not whatever it is. We have to, Sarvapadi, we have to eventually give that up. But you don't want to give that up and just go into some kind of a void. You know, you want to develop, well, who am I? Who am I? And Krishna advises, it's not my advice, it's Krishna's advice, take that false ego thing. Take that upadhi. Take that thing you're very good at and use it for me. Because he says, you know what? You're going to do it anyway. I was trying to do it when I was 3 years old. You're going to do it anyway. Those of us who've dealt with children, they are going to follow their nature anyway. And in fact, one way you can tell it's their nature is you can't stop it. You can't squish it. You can't punish them out of it. You can't shame them out of it. You can't work their life differently so they don't have any opportunity to exhibit it and then get them out of it that way. It doesn't work. It will manifest. And if you don't engage it properly, it just manifests improperly, that's all. It doesn't stop manifesting. It just manifests in some other way. So if a devotee says, well, I'm not going to do what I'm good at because then I'll be all prideful about it. They'll do it anyway. They're just going to do it in a way that will cause a disturbance to the other members of the Hare Krishna. And my personal opinion is that a lot of the people who cause a lot of the disturbance in the Hare Krishna movement are kshatriyas. Because we don't have any engagement or very little engagement for kshatriyas. We have lots of engagement for brahmanas, lots of engagement for shudras. We're getting more and more engagement for vaishyas, but very few engagement for kshatriyas. Kshatriyas means government. We never have our own government. And what are Kshatriyas into? Justice, ethics, morals, fairness. We don't have a whole lot of that in the Hare Krishna movement. If you haven't noticed, hang around for a while. We're lacking that quite glaringly. We're really good at brahminical stuff like forgiveness, and we're not really good at justice. So people who are Kshatriyas, they want these things, they see that they're lacking, and they're willing to fight for them. So they fight. Yes? Do you know devotees like this? That they're putting all their energy into fighting, and they're always talking about things that are ethical and moral and just and fair. Yes? Do you know people like this? They're Kshatriyas. But we don't have a kingdom for them. We don't have a kingdom for them. We don't have any place for them to rule. We don't have any place for them to do that for Krishna very well. I mean, some of them end up getting into outside government. So then they exhibit it improperly, like that Banasura who was fighting with the mountains, knocking off mountain peaks. So this is, therefore do it for Krishna. But we need to come to the point where we no longer identify. Arjuna was still a devotee when Krishna took away his fighting ability and he couldn't even string his Gandiva ball. He was still a devotee. That didn't change his devotion. When Krishna said, okay, you don't need to be good at this anymore. It's not needed for service anymore. I'm going to withdraw. So most of us, you know, if Radhavandana Nishwara said to us today, guess what, this thing you're really good at, you're really attached to, I'm taking it away today because you don't need it anymore. You go, ah! That's who I am! You know? We want to come to the point that that's not who I am. That I see it as Krishna's gift, well, even if my original reason for wanting it was completely nonsense. But still, it's Krishna's gift, and I should use it for him. I should use it for his glorification. I should use it to please him. And my main motive should eventually come to the point, not of, this is who I am and I'm using it for him because I'm so good, but eventually should come to the point, I'm just a servant of Krishna. This is what I have in this life. Let me use it for him as long as he's giving it to me. And once he takes it away, it doesn't matter. I'll do something else. Is that okay? It's very, very, very dangerous to intentionally do what you're not good at as a way of cultivating humility. Krishna says that. He says that. To follow another's path is dangerous. Yes?
Hi, Krishna. Thank you for the class. I'm just wondering, you mentioned that Shastra says that while dreaming, especially while sleeping, we are much closer to our original consciousness.
That's what it says right here.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm just asking. Prabhupada said it many times that sleeping is ignorance. So how does it work?
How does it work? It talks about how excessive sleeping is ignorance. Excessive anything is ignorance. Excessive eating is ignorance. Excessive recreation is ignorance. Now, interestingly enough, the great devotees who are even mystic yogis who have transcended material consciousness don't sleep very much. Right? There's actually a devotee in the London community who basically doesn't sleep. Did you know? Someone in this community who basically doesn't sleep. Sleeps about 15, 20 minutes a day and once a week for about 6 hours and has done that for well over a decade. With full energy and enthusiasm. The Goswamis only slept an hour and a half to 2 hours a day. Srila Prabhupada slept maybe 3 or 4 hours a day. So they have come to the fourth stage of consciousness, Turiya, beyond even deep sleep. And the only reason they sleep is for the physical body. So the physical body requires about 1 to 2 hours of sleep a day to repair itself. The rest of our sleeping is done for the mind. All the other hours of sleep we get are for the mind, not for the body. Unless the body's ill. And if you have somebody not have dream sleep, they'll start to actually go crazy. So when one's liberated from the mental conception of life, the only reason one needs to sleep is for the body. So we're not saying that deep sleep is spiritual. Spiritual consciousness is beyond deep sleep. Deep sleep is still a material state. Does that help at all? Anybody else? Yes? It's getting late. Do I need to end right now? Just tell me. Bring out the... This is the last one. Yes?
I have software quality assurance engineer, and sometimes when I'm trying to improve quality of software, it's difficult for me to connect the dots that how am I serving Krishna? Mm. You know, sometimes I'm driven on corporate targets that, I mean, it's difficult for me to indulge myself into that Krishna-oriented spirit. So I just want to connect those dots with your help.
Oh, very nice question. Your question, how can I think of Krishna and connect what I'm doing with Krishna while I'm at my work, was really the main question of the Bhagavad Gita. That was the main question of the Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna says, you know, I don't want to fight. It's all just nonsense. It's all material. It's all selfish. Right? Your point. It's all has to do with my ego, so I'm just not going to fight. And Krishna says, no, fight in the proper consciousness. And Arjuna had a really hard time with that. He really did. He kept asking about it. He said, well, wait a minute. Wait. You're telling me to do Buddha yoga, the yoga of intelligence, and to keep all abominable activities far distance, and then you're telling me to fight? It's contradictory. He said, I need you to do something else. Better to just go and beg. And why am I doing this? How am I going to think of you while doing this? How can someone who's fighting know you at the time of death? What is the possibility? So how do we remember Krishna even when we're working? I mean, if you think about what Arjuna was doing, when you're talking about software, Arjuna was fighting. So, you know, I have not had any interest in that kind of fighting. I mean, I have interest in intellectual debates, but not physical fighting. So I don't know. Maybe I was a warrior in some far distant lifetime, but I can't relate personally to a battlefield. But I have some idea what that might be. Right? So in a battlefield, you're trying to kill somebody who doesn't want to be killed. I would imagine that takes a lot of focus. And you're trying to avoid being killed by people who want to kill you at the same time. So someone's trying to kill you, and you don't want to be killed, and you're trying to kill them, and they don't want to be killed. And there may be many people trying to kill you at once, and you may be trying to kill many people at once, and things are moving very quickly. Now, I would imagine in that kind of a situation, hopefully I will be able to limit in this life to imagining that situation, that such a situation requires a tremendous amount of focus and mental attention. Yes? Does that make sense to everybody? I mean, you know, a little bit like that if you're negotiating your car on the streets of London and trying not to bump into anybody and have anybody bump into you. A little idea. So how are you going to meditate on Krishna in that situation? It seems like you have to have everything focused on what you're doing. But Krishna says, really, that's what he says. He says, Mam Anusmaram Yujya Cha. In fact, that's in 8.7, and in today's purport, they're quoting 8.5 and 8.6. So right after Krishna says, in 8.5, Ante Kalai Chamam Eva, one who remembers me at the last moment of life, and Yam Yam Babi Swam Bhavam, whatever you think about the time of death, you come to me. Right after he says that, he says, okay, so think of me while you fight. I mean, and while you fight, it's quite likely to be your last moment. You can't just say, well, I'm going to be out here fighting and I'll just think about the fight, and when I'm finished fighting, I'll sit down and meditate on Krishna. You know, I'll chant my japa after the battle. And that you may not have an after the battle. Right? It may be right then. And you may not have the opportunity to lie in a bed of arrows for a couple months and gather your consciousness. It may just be some sword, you know. You know, that may just be the end of that. And so you have to have that consciousness. So how are you going to have that consciousness of Krishna while you're fighting? So Krishna gives a lot of instruction in the Bhagavad Gita about how to connect everything in the world with him. So in chapter 7, chapter 9, chapter 10, and chapter 15, Krishna has a lot of I am. Like, what does he say? I am the taste of water. I am the ability of man. I am the strength of the strong. I am
japa.
I am the wind. There's so many. You know, he said, I'm the intelligence of the intelligent, I'm the strength of the strong. So while you're working with code, are you using your intelligence? I hope so, yes. That's Krishna. Krishna says, of all the senses, I am the mind. Are you using your mind? That's Krishna. Krishna says, I am the light in all luminous objects. Are you working with a luminous screen? That's Krishna. the light coming out of your little screen or your big screen. Krishna says, I'm not making this up. He says, I am the light in all luminous objects. Right? I have a little light even coming from this thing. Meditate on it. So meditate on Krishna in the world. Because that's what he's telling you to do. And then Krishna is also saying how to connect with him in terms of our consciousness. Bhagavad Gita chapter 12, text 13 to 20. One who is not envious but is a kind friend to all living entities. If you're just kind to everybody at work, then you're going to be very dear to Krishna. Now, the general mode of passion, mode of ignorance mentality is I'm working for a purpose. I'm working to write some good code. I'm working to get a paycheck. You know, I have a fruit I'm working for. And I'm not enjoying my work until I get the fruit. I mean, I may like the process because I'm good at it and it's my nature. But my real enjoyment is coming with the fruit. So Krishna says, no. Don't think like that. Don't save your enjoyment for the fruit, which may or may not come, and you may or may not like it when it comes. But take your pleasure now in offering everything to me now. Krishna, I offer this moment to you. 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 You who are there in the light of the luminous objects, you who are joining my breath of life, you who are digesting my food, you who are the light of the sun, you who are the intelligence of everybody in my office. And I am offering this particular line of code that I am writing to you now. May you enjoy it. I am offering my relationship with everyone I see to you now. May you enjoy it. And I talk about this a lot. I talked about this in Manashiksha as what I call the secret agent principle. That you don't think of yourself in terms of, I am a software engineer. You know, or even I'm a pujari. Or I'm a book distributor, or I'm a cook in the deity's kitchen. You know, that may not be your eternal service. You may be a wonderful cook now, but you know, you might be a cowherd boy who never goes into the kitchen. I mean, I don't know. You know, it may not be your eternal situation. So rather, I am working for Krishna's company. I'm working for Krishna. He's my boss. And our product is not computer code. Our product is love of God. And that's my real mission. These other things are just a cover. They're just they're quite literally a cover. But just like the spy has their cover. They're just a cover. It's so I can get an inroad to spread love of God. Frankly, even if we say, I'm a brahmachari preacher of ISKCON Soho, that's not your eternal identity either. So please don't think the brahmachari book distributors of ISKCON Soho, they're closer to working in their eternal identity than you are. They're not. And you can just as much spread love of God in the office as they can on the streets. In fact, in some ways, you're better positioned to do so. How am I going to spread love of God? That's my mission. My mission is to spread as much love of God as I can. Now, that might be measured in number of books. It might be measured in numbers of sticks of incense. It might be measured in, you know, in something external like that. But it can also be measured in people coming to you and saying, you know, there's something really special about you. What is it? I remember I went to Rathiatra one time and I had to take my son and another boy in to use the toilet while we were waiting for the parade to start. They were 3 years old. And the guard in the museum where we took them in said, I've never seen children like that. What do you feed them? Yeah. So there's so many ways that we can be, you know, I'm here to get my mission done. I'm here to get my mission done. So I want to have a very expert cover, but I have a mission. Is that okay? Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srila Bhagavatam ki jai.